Could we call this meeting of the House Hess Committee to order, please? It is April 23rd and 3:04. Present Representative Gary Davis, myself, Representative Bundy, Representative Toohey, Representative Robinson, and Representative Bryce. We do have a quorum. On today's calendar, we have House Bill 244, Calculation of State Aid for Education, and House Bill 253, insurance for prostate and cervical cancer tests. House Bill 488 has been rescheduled for a week from today. We will open with House Bill 244, and is there anyone else signed up to testify? We got all these brains and no one else? No, the rest of my chicken. Department of Ed would talk to us about 244. We'd appreciate it. And for the record, please.
Thank you, Chairman Bundy. For the record, I'm Rick Cross, Deputy Commissioner of Department of Education, and I have a lot of experts with me if you should have questions. Just briefly, I'll point out the difference between Senate Bill 244, as it was originally submitted to the legislature, and the committee substitute that's before you that's 244, and just kind of go through the differences. The committee substitute has an amendment which reimburses the Anchorage Run pupil transportation at the same level as the contractor rate. This was not in the original bill. We've provided you a fiscal note that shows the impact of changing that rate of reimbursement for the Anchorage School District. And that note shows that for fiscal year 97, there would be an increased cost of $1,992,000. In our fiscal note, we've also indicated that there could potentially be a cost for fiscal year 96, and we want to point out to you why that is. We admit it is somewhat speculative. Section 8 of the bill says that the act takes effect immediately, and should the governor sign this bill prior to July 1, 1997, then potentially it could impact and require a proration of this year's transportation funding because the increase to the Anchorage School District or the entitlement figured in under this year's schedule would be $2,050,243. So that is one substantive change between the Senate bill and the committee substitute. The committee substitute also contains an amendment on portables that says that portables will not count into the space when used in figuring unhoused students. It's currently the practice of the department not to count that space now, so that amendment would not change our practice. The committee substitutes increases the deductible PL 874 from REAAs from 95% in the original bill, which would have started in the 97 fiscal year, and kicks it in this year at 96%. And then, of course, both bills give a payment to REAAs of $500 per instructional unit in order to meet disparity. The committee substitute contains a hold harmless. What Senate Finance did was amend the bill to have it take effect this year in order to minimize the increased the cost of the $500 instructional unit to the REAAs. In the original bill, next year we had planned to pay out the $500 payment, but in effect recover it by increasing the deductible PL 874. What the Senate amendment does is kick that system in this year rather than next. The original bill's method of accomplishing that was to get a $1.2 million appropriation in order to cover that $500 payment, and did not increase the deductible. So what happened is they put a hold harmless in so that any district that would lose money as a result of that 96% deductible and then $500 payback would not, in fact, lose money but would be held even. The original bill allowed the Department of Education to adjust the $500 allotment to make sure that we met disparity, if such an adjustment should be necessary. The committee substitute does not allow for that. The original bill funded single sites through the formula program. The committee substitute does not. The committee substitute sunsets the provision for the public school foundation formula on 6/30/97, and the way we interpret that is there'd be no funding formula after 6/30/97, and unless and until a new one was adopted. Again, the effective dates are different, and the fiscal notes are different. The fiscal note for Senate Bill 244 of 311 does include the transportation piece. It does not include the transportation piece. Those are essentially the differences. Members of the department and I are here to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, if we could, on the hold harmless, do you know which districts and how much money is involved there?
Eddie, do you have that? If I could have Eddie Jeans from the department.
Sort of dangerous, though.
Push that table forward. Do me a favor. Watch this.
I'm watching.
Our letter
microphone
will apply for
it. It makes the secretary's eyes light up when you drop that on the floor. Eddie, if you would, for the record.
For the record, my name is Eddie James. I'm a project assistant with the Department of Education. Chairman Bundy, the hold harmless section basically just keeps districts at the level that they would have been funded in fiscal year 96 had this piece of legislation not passed. We do have a schedule. I hope it's in with your fiscal note. If not, I can provide you with another copy.
Maybe I haven't looked deep enough. Oh, okay, I have it here now. Okay,
and there's nine districts that would qualify for the hold harmless provision. It should be titled Section 5, Hold Harmless at the top.
Mm-hmm.
So this just ensures that these districts do not lose any funding in fiscal year 96.
This would apply, but that loss would occur in 97. They're not losing money in 96. But
Representative Bundy, some districts will experience some loss in fiscal year 97.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that's indicated on the next page where we have a $20,000 increase at the bottom right-hand corner.
Yeah.
You'll see that there are some districts with brackets,
mm-hmm.
and that would be the state aid that they would lose in fiscal year 97. The hold harmless provision essentially is because the districts already have their budgets established for the current year, and we're getting very close to closing out schools, and it would be hard for them to adjust for that in the current year.
Okay, thank you. On the effective date, sounds like it would be cheap insurance to change the effective date so that it doesn't become effective until July 1.
Chairman Bundy, the problem with changing the effective date until July 1 for sections 3, 4, and 5 is that the recapture for this year in order to what the Senate Finance amendments did was took the mechanism that we were suggesting for next year and wanted to implement it a year earlier in order not to incur the full $1.2 million supplemental cost in the budget. And so some aspect of the bill has to be retroactive in order to make to enable us to deduct the PL 874 at 95% and return the $500 payment to make the adjustments for this year. So in order for that mechanism to work, there would have to be retroactivity.
So we have good news and we have bad news.
Chairman Bunny, bad news insofar as the...
Well, if they wanted to take a look at it, as figuring into this year's, you said if it takes effect to before July 1. Districts on the people transportation could... Yeah.
The cleanest way to accomplish that, I mean, at least my opinion, would be to amend Section 8, not the retroactive part of it, to make it...
Yeah, that's what I was referring to.
Yeah, not Section 7, which is...
No, right. I'm sorry, we were going the same place, but coming from a different route. No, I was talking about Section 8, which would, to amend that, say July 1.
Right.
Yeah, that would... I did not mean Section 7 with the retroactive to July 1, 95. Representative Robinson.
Yeah, maybe you can tell me what was the thinking on Section 6 to, if I understand it, this will sunset. We have to start all over. Is that to...
Representative Robinson, through the chair, Section 6 was... added in Senate Finance, and I wouldn't want to characterize the author's intent except to say that there was a clear message that they wanted a new formula and that wanted this to be a temporary fix and not a permanent fix. And this would make it clear that, or I think the purpose would be to put everyone on notice that you better come up with something. I
would characterize it as a Michigan approach.
The Michigan.
When they wanted a new funding formula, they simply canceled the old one. Said there is no longer any taxes available. Come up with a new plan. Representative Robinson.
Yeah, through the chair, just again, I'm trying to understand this a little better. So where are you at this point on getting ready for a new formula? And is this really putting a tight rope around your neck?
Representative Robinson, through the chair, the Commissioner Holloway met all last week with the State Board of Education. Eddie and Dr. Elliott and I will be meeting with her later this afternoon. They've set an aggressive schedule to adopt a new formula, and we expect and are planning that the governor will submit a new formula and legislation in January of 1997. So,
Representative Robinson.
So just one other question then. So if for any reason you don't make that timeline, where do we fall to? Would we have to again pass another enabling legislation to keep what's on the books?
Through the chair, Representative Robinson, you'd either have to modify and extend existing legislation. There have been years when there, in this state, where there has been no funding formula, quote unquote, and there's been a temporary measure for continuing funding for districts from one year to the next.
Thanks.
And to let the record reflect that Representative Veazey and Ropeberg have joined us, and the chair would observe that the state board worked long and hard. Spent a good deal of time and effort and money this past summer to rewrite the formula, got to making the hard decisions and stopped because it was challenging for them. I'll be kinder than when I said they got to the hard part and then blinked. This will encourage them to get to the hard part and keep going. Other questions?
It's us to do.
Right.
Representative Davis.
So it's my understanding that the amendment on the people transportation has added a $2 million fiscal note to the bill. Is that correct?
Well, Representative Davis, through the chair, that's correct. It's added nearly $2 million fiscal note for fiscal year 97. And potentially a fiscal note for fiscal year 96 of $2,050,000.
Okay, so, Mike, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
So that's about a $4 million additional funding request that this legislation as it stands now will require.
Through the chair, Representative Davis, yes.
And if that funding isn't provided, and the legislation passes as it is, then what happens?
Through the chair, Representative Davis, the department would prorate the transportation program. And that proration would result in a proportional deduction to all school districts in the state that have transportation programs.
Thank you.
Would it be fair to say that this $4 million is somewhat close to the $4 million originally cut from pupil transportation in the governor's proposed budget?
It would, Chairman Bundy, it would be fair to say that if the original cut was $4 million. But I don't have that number off the top of my head.
Well, I think it's we're in the ballpark. Other questions? We have some other folks signed up to testify, and I assume you'll stay with us.
Very well.
Mr. Marshall, it's been a very quiet couple of weeks without your help.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I've been active on the other side. We would like, for the record, my name is Vernon Marshall, Executive Director, NEA Alaska. We'd like to offer some comments and observations concerning the CS 244. I'd like to preface the remarks by saying that, you know, we feel it's a tremendous obligation and an important obligation that, you know, Alaska educate all its children, and that the public schools have a responsibility. We don't select. We want to accept all children, and we want to educate those kids to the best of their opportunity. To do that many times, we have to rely on funding, and we have long been an advocate of additional funding for the schools. We have, in our observations about the formula, you know, there are generally some concerns that we have, but we feel that what makes the formula anemic many times is the fact that we don't adequately fund, and then local governmental units don't oftentimes pass that funding on to local school districts so that children benefit. As we look at 244, we are concerned about the fact that single-site school districts have been omitted. We believe that's a cost of about, $3.2 million in the scheme of an $850-plus million, you know, budget program for schools. We feel that single sites should be a priority. There are kids that exist in those single sites, and they need to be taken care of. We also believe the disparity is an issue that federal disparity issue is an issue that does need to be addressed. We're concerned that if it's not addressed, it will have a negative impact through proration on all children in the state by actually having the, you know, effect of reducing the instructional unit by a couple of $1,000s. And we feel that at a time when schools are attempting to prepare kids for the challenges of a new century, it's critical, and we're talking about the need to upgrade and modernize facilities relative to not only the books that they read, but the technology they take advantage of. Now is not the time to jeopardize funding, you know, for kids as we try to, you know, prepare those kids for the new century. We are concerned about the section that deals with June 30, 1997. I understand what happened in Michigan, having, you know, received some reports about the Michigan experience. I think that, again, in Alaska, given its uniqueness, thank goodness we're not Michigan, but we are Alaska, I think that a better approach to dealing with the whole issue of the whole formula, and as I understand it, the Department of the State Board of Education is carefully looking at the formula, entertaining proposals and ideas, hopefully developing a process that's designed to involve the public, the legislature, and everyone in terms of trying to look at deficiencies, if they exist, and ways to deal with a formula that best deals with the educational needs of kids. That process can take place, is taking place. We feel that, in a sense, sunsetting the formula, I think raises the apprehension of a lot of people. I mean, and I guess, you know, yeah, I accused a while ago of delving in the continual state of paranoia. I'm not trying to be paranoid about this, but it is important, I think, that schools, you know, be assured some stability, and I don't know that I necessarily understand the history of the past when, you know, basically somehow schools were taken care of when certain items discontinued, sunsetted, or died. But here I think we, you know, there's a statement of state policy that we have to be concerned about, and I would encourage the committee to, you know, at least remove the section and, you know, try to take a serious look at the bill, look at single sites, look at the disparity, look at the sunset. We think those things ought to be addressed and removed. And with that, I appreciate the time that you've given us and be glad to try to answer questions.
Representative Tui has
a question. Just a quick question. Bryn, were you involved in the meetings during the summer?
I was involved in some of the meetings. I was not a participant of the committee. I was an observer. But I had an opportunity to follow and hear much of the report.
Kind of a broad question to you. Do you think they could have come up with an answer?
Representative Tui, I'm not trying to give you a political answer. I think they had a tremendous amount of work to do. I don't know that they were given the resources and the time to really get it done. I mean, I think they could come up with an answer. I do think that you could see, you know, some polarization that probably did take place during the process of those meetings. But I think that could have been overcome. And I think that, you know, that group, if that group is empowered or another group is empowered and charged with a responsibility, I think given time and support, I think they can. I think it's within their capacity to do that.
Representative Tui, if I could, because I was an observer also, an interested observer, not always there, but I would like to characterize the end result of what was accomplished. And they did spend a great deal of time and employed some national experts. They had a number of people involved. These are not easy decisions, and sometimes it's a gestation period, perhaps, that making hard decisions does not always happen rapidly. But they came up with three possible solutions: status quo, hope for a miracle; change the formula, hope for a miracle by an infusion of a lot of money; change the formula and live within the current budget, which would mean there'd be clear winners and losers in various school districts, and that's why the decision didn't go forward. Because two of them were not viable options, and the third was not comfortable.
Yeah, Chairman Tui, through the chair, I think, though, the committee did, you know, address a couple of issues. One was the formula fix for single-site school districts, and the other was to minimally address the problem of us not addressing the federal disparity issue. And I think that was put in place primarily because of changes on the federal level, but I think some work was done. Was enough work done? Probably not. But, you know, it's kind of the job of a leader, and your job is to keep hope alive. And I think that, you know, that's something that definitely could be done if we could sit down and keep that process going with the interest now of the state board.
I think June 30th, 1997, they will have an answer. And you'll probably be part of it, so we all need to do work on it. And we might not like it, but it's going to be an answer.
And again, I would like to say that it's my understanding that the state board intends to continue their quest, and they are, it is a high priority, and they will be continuing work on this. This is probably our way of applauding and encouraging their efforts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions?
Thanks,
for Mr. Marshall?
Bryn.
Thank you. Lorraine Farrell, please.
Who hasn't been home in 3 weeks or something awful?
Yeah, it's been a while. I came here from Orlando and did some wonderful work for the Alaska Association of School Boards on a scholarship committee, reading essays from children all over the state, and it renewed my hope in the upcoming generation and in the future of the state of Alaska. So some wonderful surveys written, or essays written, about how it takes a whole village or a whole community to raise a child, and there was a lot of encouraging messages in those essays.
If we could, if you'd identify yourself and your association just for the record.
That's right. I am Lorraine Farrell. I am the Vice President of the Anchorage School Board, and I'm here to address the CSSB 244 finance as amended. And particularly Section 1, I would like to support this particular section, which corrects a disparity in transportation reimbursement that the Anchorage School District has been living with for quite a while. This particular section would reimburse us 100% for our district-run routes as well as our contracted routes. And to us, this is very important because currently we are funding that portion, which is not state-funded, of course, out of our operating budget. And as times get tighter, we can find better uses for this particular general operating money, especially since every other district in the entire state gets 100% reimbursement on their transportation. So I would just want to encourage the committee to keep that section in and to eliminate this disparity that's been particularly aimed at Anchorage for many years.
Well, just remember, envy is a great form of flattery.
Well, thank you.
Followed immediately by greed, probably.
Probably so.
Questions for Ms. Farrell. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Farrell, how long has this disparity been in existence?
I can't tell you in numbers of years, but I know it's been quite a while. I think originally the disparity was put into place when there was such a difference in compensation for contracted drivers versus district drivers. And now that those two are pretty much in alignment, there's not a reason to not 100% fund both. And in our case, we have no other contractor other than Laidlaw that could provide this service to our students. And so we're caught between a rock and a hard spot. We're continuing to run routes on our own to put us in a favorable position to be able to negotiate the contracted routes with Laidlaw.
Representative Davis.
To what degree has this disparity been addressed in the legislative process? This is the first I've heard of it. I don't know why it hasn't been addressed.
Well, I think this has been one of those sleepers that got done, and then it just no one noticed it or realized that it was continuing to go forward. And in our review of our transportation dollars, which we've been looking at very closely, it came up again, and so we wanted to bring it before this body and ask for it to be equalized.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you. Do we have other public testimony on Senate Bill 244? Representative Robinson?
Well, maybe we could have the department come up and explain a little bit more what this language does for the rest of the state.
Certainly. And for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is James Elliott, School Finance with the Department of Education. I have with me Bill Wright, who administers the Pupil Transportation Program, and he can give you some background on the difference between the reimbursement for Anchorage's contract route and for their district run route.
I think the questions were other parts of the state other than Anchorage. Do you have specific questions, Representative Robinson?
Well, no, I'd just like them maybe to kind of, I mean, I know this language was added. What does it mean in the grand scheme of things? What does it mean to districts like mine? What does it mean to other districts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Robinson, the effect of this amendment, if it doesn't get additional funding, will result in about another 5% proration of the program. So each district will receive 5% less funding.
So in June, it will be 5% less in Fairbanks and Kenai and all the other areas except for Anchorage.
Anchorage will be prorated as well. They would receive 5% less.
Though I like your version better, Representative Robinson. Representative Easy.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm a little confused as to why this wording would avoid or not avoid a proration. I mean, money in the pot's the money in the pot. Why does changing the formula, I admit it is a change in the formula, though I don't understand it. How's that going to avoid a proration?
I'm sorry, avoid it?
Right. Yeah, there's a proration if there's if the money is less than the expenses, if the appropriation is less than the expenses, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and then we, under the existing statute, that's a certain formula, which I don't know what it is, but under the proposed changes, this formula changes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vesey, that's true. If we base our budget on what we estimate to be the total entitlement, and if we receive less money than what we need to fully fund them, everybody would be prorated equally.
Equally, now, that's strange. We're equally on a per-dollar basis or a per-student basis or per-mile basis?
On a per-dollar basis.
So it's just a straight across-the-board per-dollar basis proration?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Vesey, the way we reimburse under the pupil transportation program is it's on an actual cost basis. It depends on their contracted daily rates. So that amount changes over the year based on whether we add buses, COLA increases, whatnot. So this is our best guess right now what our full funding level is going to be when we come before the legislature. But during the year, that amount can go up
or down.
But how does this proposed amendment to the statute change this formula? That's what I don't understand yet.
It increases Anchorage's entitlement by approximately the $1.2 million. So unless we get additional funding to cover that, our estimated entitlement in the budget is $1.9 million
short. I didn't understand. So this wording might as well say the Anchorage School District is entitled to more money.
Yes.
I understand.
And hearing no further objections, we'll open then.
Further
questions. Further testimony. Representative Robin.
Rupert. Just a clarification. I think it's section 4 there about the $500 mm-hmm. REAA. Is that that speaking to the disparity problem? Is that why that is there? Or?
Of a different type than the busing.
No, I know. I mean the federal disparity definition.
Right. It brings up the floor.
Right. Okay. That was the purpose of that?
Yes.
And why did that occur? I mean, why did we run into this problem?
Well, because the Fed's changed the standard.
Oh, okay, that's right.
25%.
I can remember now. Thanks.
Further questions? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Elliott, you talked about the non-counting of the portables, students housed in portables. And I remember that discussion from last year, too. It seems kind of silly to those students are there. They should be counted. Refresh my memory of the situation.
As I understand it, prior to this year, districts that had students in portable classrooms, it was not counted as unhoused for the purposes of requesting money to build facilities. The department has grappled with the issue of unhoused students in portable or classrooms through the Bond Reimbursement and Grant Review Committee that was set up under Senate Bill 7 that passed the legislature in 1993. They grappled with the issue for better than a year and were unable to resolve the issue. But the department, based on its own interpretation, this year has left it up to districts as to whether to count those students as housed or unhoused. So this amendment, as it is now, doesn't do anything different than what we're doing. It did hurt Anchorage a year or so ago, I'm told, because when they made their submission to the department, a lot of the students that they had in portables were not counted as unhoused, and therefore they didn't qualify for needed space.
If I might, Representative Davis, students who were in portables were considered adequately housed, and not acceptable. What this says, they are not adequately housed. And certainly housed, and it's certainly there, just not adequately housed. Further questions? Representative Vesey.
Yes, I guess just curious about how the Anchorage school system works, but I take it they must own their own buses or something?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Vesey. The Anchorage District operated, they do purchase their own buses. They're the largest district operated transportation system in the state. The next largest is Barrow, and they operate about 10 buses of their own. And Anchorage is also unique in that they...
Barrow operates 10 buses of their own.
Yes.
Anchorage operates 50. 100. 100.
About 81.
81.
Representative,
let me.
Have you finished?
Yes, I'm finished.
We also have contract, Laidlaw contract, I do believe.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Toohey. Anchorage is unique in that they have district operated and contracted within the same community. And Laidlaw operates, I believe, 158 buses in that community, and the district operates about 80, 81, 82.
And would it be fair to say that the district started out with a busing program and they owned some buses and had some employees, and then as things grew, they chose to contract?
I am not aware of the history there, if it started out with just the district and then went to contracting, or if they both came about at the same time.
Okay, thank you. Representative Vesey?
Yes, I was just going to ask if there was a... some kind of evaluation of which service was more cost effective.
Unfortunately, we had a school board member here who has now left. Her testimony was, and you may have missed that, is that by providing their own, they set a base in the area, then provide competition with the only vendor that provides this service, and so that they can keep the bids down. Either keep the bid down or we buy more of our own.
I might be able to add a little bit to that, Mr. Please. Chair, Representative Vesey. There was a study done, oh, I don't know, in the early 80s, that did compare the district operated with the contractors, comparing their rates and the services and whatnot. And that's when the district operated rate of reimbursement was established, the percentage, which was 66.83%. Since then, that has just been carried over.
You completely lost me there. I mean, 66.3% of what?
Of their actual cost, of what actually costs them to operate the district-operated program. It includes the transportation director, the purchase of the buses, drivers.
And that's to equate it to the cost of contracting for the service.
Yes, because the contracted is much cheaper than the district operating their own buses. And if you look at on a per-student reimbursement, on a per-bus, on a per-mile basis, the contracted is always cheaper than what the district can operate for themselves. And I'm aware that there is just a study done by an accounting firm in Anchorage that hasn't been released yet, but they have been working on it, that compares the two operations.
You have any figures on that, or we?
No, it hasn't been released yet.
Well, we know what that means.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
Further questions? Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 244? Seeing none, we will close public testimony. Representative
Mr. Chairman, Poole. Yes, I'd like to make an amendment on Section 8 to read July 1, 1996.
The amendment is to
delete this act takes effect immediately, and have it read: this act takes effect July 1, 1996.
Committee understand the amendment. Would the department like to comment?
I think it's pretty neutral.
That would
Rick.
See.
Rick Cross, Deputy Commissioner, that would eliminate the change the fiscal note to only include the $1,900,000+ for the fiscal year 97.
The fiscal
note for pupil transfer.
Yeah, and
eliminate.
If I might ask, the fiscal note for 97 right now is $1,992,000.
That's correct.
And you're saying that there is some possibility that it could have gone up, but this amendment would keep it at $1,992,000.
This amendment would eliminate the potential of the current year fiscal impact of 2 million $50,243.
Okay. Representative Robinson.
Yeah, before he goes, I'm still trying to figure out, I'm still trying to understand this. Just to me in simple terms, is this good or bad?
through the chair, Representative Robinson, it depends on your point of view.
I'm still trying to figure it out.
It, you know, it, if you believe that the 66 2/3% rate for reimbursement of the school transportation program in Fairbanks in Anchorage is unfair, and that 100% is fair, then they're only getting half a loaf in with this amendment, and they're getting it corrected prospectively, but not for this year. It's predicated on the belief that that reimbursement rate is inappropriate and that they're entitled to a higher rate.
And I'd like to speak to the amendment that I certainly agree. I'd like to see the 100% reimbursement, but in the spirit of compromise that the big Anchorage doesn't take everything, we change prospectively, and it cuts the fiscal note for this year and a half. Further questions about Representative Easy?
No, I didn't have a question, no.
Is there an objection to the amendment? Hearing none, the amendment is adopted. Representative Easy?
No, I did not object to the amendment. The amendment's adopted?
Yes.
I'd like to propose amendment number 2.
Okay. And Representative Easy, would you like to move your amendment?
Yes. Basically, being a defender of the private sector, this amendment clarifies that the reimbursement of the transportation cost will be on a daily cost comparison basis rather than just a level basis, which testimony indicated that was to be the same percentage of total cost. So this amendment would take it back to a basis of if a municipality wishes to provide its own transportation, it will be reimbursed at the lower unit cost available through the contracting procedure.
Would it be fair to say that this would gut this section?
I don't think that's fair, but it certainly would neuter the transfer of capital, yes.
Oh, okay, now I understand. Well, we don't have no steer capital. There's an objection to the amendment. Representative Davis.
It would be my understanding that this amendment would return to status quo like it has been in the past 5, 6, 8, 10 years.
Yes, it is. Rick, our transportation expert.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis. No, it would not return to the status quo. Currently, they're reimbursed on a percentage of their actual costs instead of on a daily rate per bus, which is how the contracts are reimbursed.
And as you testified earlier, we don't know what the daily rate of the contractor is at this point. So adopting this amendment, we would say this district would be reimbursed at?
We know what the daily rates are for the contracts. We don't know what it is for the district-operated portion of it.
I'm sorry, I thought I had understood you to say there was just a comparison done, and the contract daily rates, the audit shows that. It just doesn't show the district rates. Is that what you're saying now?
Yes. Yeah, the contracts are on a daily rate. The review that was done compared the two operations, but I don't believe it established a daily rate for the district operated.
Representative Davis.
My recollection of the Anchorage School Board member was that she felt the costs were getting fairly even. Did I understand that? Although $2 million even is not quite too even.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think we're comparing apples and oranges. Remember, currently the district is reimbursed at 66% of actual costs. I don't know how that compares to, it's not 66% of the cost of the private operator. We're not reimbursed at the private level. We're just reimbursed at the 66% of the actual cost. That doesn't compare with the private operator's cost. We're not sure what 66% of the actual cost of the district is compared to the private operator. Representative Robinson.
So I'm just trying to, again, understand here, but because I was under the impression that this amendment brought us back to where we were originally.
Mr. Chair, Representative Robinson, it's extremely close. It's much closer than what the First Amendment does. But I can't say what the impact is of reimbursing the district at the contracted daily rate is.
Representative Vesey.
I just would like to clarify that this simply says if a public agency wants to compete with the private sector, that they can do that, and we will reimburse them, but we're only going to reimburse them at the same cost that we can contract for and receive the service. Now, I can't tell you how that compares to the existing system because I've never run the numbers, but it does say we will not have two unit costs for pupil transportation.
And I don't know if there's any way we can find Lorraine to ask a question. She might ask Laura Lee if she'd check the second floor and see if Lorraine Farrell's around. Representative Bryce, you had a question?
It's been asked about a dozen different ways. I want to ask it another different way. This will stop considering the fact that we're currently not fully funding student transportation, at least on our side of the budget. That's still sort of nebulous as to what's happening there. What this does is this ensures that, say, my district doesn't get brought down based on the old language. There's not a transfer of funds, or not as great of a transfer of funds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bryce, I can't answer that right now because I don't know what the effect of reimbursing the district is at the same rate as the contracted.
Okay.
But it would certainly be less than $1.9 million of the original fiscal note.
Representative Robinson.
Well, being we have this amendment before us, how would you get us back to the status quo? Just remove the existing language from line 8 all the way down to 12 on page 1?
Mr. Chair, Representative Robinson, that would bring us back to the status quo, would be to remove the original language, the original amendment. I might add that we have met with representatives from the Anchorage School District and have agreed to revisit the issue of what their percent reimbursement is for the district operated.
I think we're going to have Ms. Farrell back with us to give us perhaps some more information specifically about Anchorage. But again, to clarify, there are only two school districts in the state that own their own buses, Barrow being one and Anchorage being the other. No, that's not correct. How many school districts?
Mr. Chair, just off the top of my head, I would say 15 districts operate their own buses, but they're typically one or two bus operations. Usually when you get above that level, the districts choose to contract it out.
And these then are all small cities or districts?
Yes.
So they only two?
One to two buses.
And the only barrel was questionable if it could be considered a large district, but Anchorage is the only large district. Fairbanks does not own any of its own buses.
No, they contract.
Representative Davis.
Mr. Chairman, I talked to the Kenai School District this afternoon, and they indicated they have their own contract. They have their own in-house busing, I believe, in Seward, because the core contract for the Central Peninsula area is conducive, geographically conducive to a contract, where Seward, being separated from the Central Peninsula, would boost the contract price per bus because of the distance between the central area. So I don't know how many buses, but Seward has overall probably close to 800 to 1,000 students probably. And so there would be a number of buses in Seward. But it was also indicated that the district preferred that also because they have something to compare when the contract prices come in. So if it is going to be beneficial to the district to contract, if they come in under their in-house price, then it's beneficial. So they have something to compare to. I also was under the impression or had been alluded to that Mat-Su has some of their own buses also. And I would assume probably the same rationale would apply if there are remote areas that don't fit into the central core, where if they did include them in the contract, it would increase the contract price. So, and I can't speak of Matt, so I was just told that they do have. So the rationale seems appropriate to have something to compare to. So I would probably indicate that there were probably 15 school districts and probably definitely to different varying degrees that they would use in-house.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, that's correct. The Kenai School District does operate the buses in Seward. They also have contracts three other contractors within the district. The Seward operation has about 8 buses, I believe. Mat-Su also owns their own buses, but they use them for activity trips. They're not reimbursed by the state. All their state-reimbursed to-from-school transportation is by contractor, by Laidlaw.
Lorraine
yes,
Farrell is back with us, and we are discussing a possible amendment that would allow reimbursement only to the daily cost level, in other words, to your contracted cost. And we had questions about how that would impact, as Anchorage is the biggest owner of its own busing system, how that would impact Anchorage.
We would prefer to have it on the you caught me as I was going into another meeting. We would prefer to have it reimbursed on a per route basis or a daily basis rather than the cost per hour basis.
This would be on a daily basis.
Daily cost.
But what it amounts to is you get reimbursed for the amount.
Oh, thank you.
You get reimbursed for the amount that you pay the private contractor, Laidlaw, and not for the amount that it costs you to run your buses.
We wouldn't agree with that amendment. That would definitely impact what we're doing.
I assumed that. However, I was trying to get an idea of the amount of impact. What's the difference
between...
Well,
we can look at... what it would take to bring it up to parity, and that is the $1.9 million at this point, which is what the CS...
Well, no, this is a different thing. You get reimbursed at 66% now.
Right.
It takes 1.9 to bring you up to 100%.
Right.
What we're doing is comparing now the cost of the 100% cost of Anchorage-owned buses as compared to the Laidlaw buses. And this amendment would reimburse you at what you pay Laidlaw per day. And do you have an idea what it costs per day to run an Anchorage bus as opposed to what it costs per day to run a Laidlaw bus?
I think there are people in this room that would have the answer to that.
They don't seem to.
We
they seem to have left.
They don't find that yet.
I can find out real quick.
Well, the bottom line is it costs... It costs you more money to run you, Anchorage District, more money to run the buses that the Anchorage District owns per day than it does to cost to run a Laidlaw bus per day. And you had testified earlier that the reason you maintain the city, you know, logic would say, okay, contract them all
right,
and get rid
right,
of the city.
Right.
And you testified earlier that you maintain the city portion to provide competition to Laidlaw, because without the competition, you feed Laidlaw, prices would go way up.
Yes, there would be there would be a 15% increase immediately in the cost of busing if the school district's busing went away.
And that's 15%, not just because there had to be more Laidlaw buses, but because...
That would be an overall increase of 15%. To the cost of busing, because the competition has gone away. You will then have a sole source or a monopoly.
Which would have just about how I'd have said it. Representative Beasley. Uh-huh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I've been around the public procurement process for some 24 years. And, you know, as just an old saying, that dog won't hunt. I mean, the competitive marketplace will step in and they will fill the gap. If what you were saying had any validity, we would see the federal government building its own airplanes just to keep the contractors in line. They've learned a long time ago not to try to compete with the private sector, because the competition for the opportunity to make a dollar is a far stronger incentive than anything you can do by threatening them with a couple of buses that probably cost you 50% more per hour to operate than they do.
Well, if I could respond to that.
Ms. Farrell.
I believe that we're looking at a rather unique situation in Alaska, in that Laidlaw has systematically bought out all the other bus companies. And so for another bus company to come in and establish a competitive market, I think we're looking at a situation that just isn't there.
Well, the marketplace seems to belie that fact. They have bought out other companies simply because they have underbid them. And if they can operate at those levels, then we should encourage them to do so. But that doesn't, I know in Fairbanks, there is no shortage of people bidding on busing contracts. And I know that people look all over the world at these type of contracts. I know I have worked on projects where you bid maintenance for institutions, and people go all around the world to bid on these opportunities, to bid on these maintenance contracts. It's the incentive behind the profit motive cannot be underestimated. It is tremendous.
Representative Tui.
Do you have any idea, if it isn't confidential, their approximate annual contract for Laidlaw? And do you have any, I mean, is that privilege information?
As far as the total amount, no, that's public information, but I didn't come prepared with those numbers today. Is there another time when I could supply you with more information? Or is this
have an amendment
today?
we've got to act on it.
Could that amendment be postponed?
No.
At all?
We're almost out of here.
Okay.
We too are going home.
I understand.
My turn?
Yes,
your turn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd also agree with Representative Vesey about the competition in the Kenai School District. There, if there is only one bus contractor, then you have to decide whether you want your in-house or your out-house or whichever. but a couple of years ago, the Mayflower came in and outbid Laidlaw. And you're correct in that Laidlaw did buy them out. And if I could be assured that Laidlaw would buy out the next contract that won, I'd sure like to be the one that would be able to submit that contract if I knew that they were going to buy me out. I'd be getting a lot of something for nothing. So it is there, and I don't think there's any laws that dictate that Laidlaw will be the only bidder in Anchorage. I think it's just probably the nature of the beast at this time. But I'm sure that at some date, and maybe next year, there would be competition in a bid.
Seeing no further questions, we have an amendment number two before us. There has been an objection. Would you take the vote, please?
Representative Vesey?
Yes.
Representative Davis?
Yes.
Representative Roper?
No.
Representative Bryce?
Yes.
Representative Robinson?
Yes.
Co-Chair Tui?
Yes.
Co-Chair Bondi?
No. This bill is tabled until the next meeting. We'll go to the next bill. And I'll turn the gavel over to my able assistant co-chair.
Okay. Have you ever tried these?
Now you want to come up?
Huh? You do work.
But well, aspirin works.
Came back.
Thank you.
Didn't do any good.
The next bill we have up is Senate Bill 253, Insurance for Prostate and Cervical Cancer Tests. We have several people signed up for...
the rule.
Several people signed up.
This is the amendment. Didn't pass.
The sponsor, is he here? I'm sorry. Jim, please proceed.
For the record, my name is Christine Pellet, and I'm a student intern for Senator Duncan. He is unable to be here. Co-chairs Bundy and Tui, members of the House Hess Committee, thank you for scheduling Senate Bill 253, an act relating to insurance coverage for costs of prostate and cervical cancer detection. The importance of screening for cancer is well documented. Both prostate and cervical cancer can be detected early by simple screening procedures, and Senator Duncan believes that insurance companies should provide coverage for these screening procedures. Prostate cancer accounts for 36% of all male cancer and is the second leading cause of death in men after lung cancer, as reported by the National Cancer Institute. It's estimated that this year in the United States, 25,000 men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer, and about 40,000 men will die from this disease. Although often presumed to develop slowly, nearly two-thirds of new cancer cases have spread beyond the prostate gland by the time of diagnosis. In addition to coverage of the PSA test, SB 253 would require coverage for cervical cancer screening. Cervical cancer accounts for about 16% of all cancers in women. It is estimated that nearly half of approximately 15,000 women who are diagnosed annually with the condition never underwent early screening procedures, which could have led to highly successful treatment. Senate Bill 253 makes health issues a priority. Senator Duncan would welcome your support in requiring that insurance companies cover the cost of prostate and cervical cancer screening. I'd be happy to answer any questions you do have.
Representative, we'll go away in a minute. Representative
Mosquito.
Representative Roper, you had a question?
Hey, Mr. Chairman. Can you tell us what are the approximate costs of the PSA test and anything else that would be covered, and also the Pap smear test now?
Approximate cost?
I have the answer to that.
If you're going to testify, please come over and identify yourself.
Where is the amendment?
My name is Janet Parker. I'm with the Division of Retirement and Benefits.
Go ahead, Janet, please.
The cost of a PSA test runs between $60 and $70 within the state of Alaska, and I don't have numbers on Pap smears.
I do. As a recipient of a Pap smear for many years, between $60 and $80.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
I just point out that we had a health fair here a couple of weeks ago. I, for one, took advantage of the PSA screening test, and it was $30.
Right. That also included other things?
No.
That was just for the PSA. Thank you.
And the other things required an additional $25.
Other further questions? Hearing none, thank you. Thank you very much. Are there other testifiers? Yes, excuse me. Jean Daw, if you'll come and testify, Jean, please.
Thank you, co-chairs and committee, for hearing my testimony. I'm testifying on behalf of AARP and VFW. I'm a volunteer. And here I'm talking to you about something that not very many men want to talk about. I'm talking about prostate cancer. And even when you go to your doctor, men don't talk about it. My doctor had to ask me and tell me all about it and encourage me to take the blood test, and I did. And I was surprised at the number of people that just don't talk about it. And yet when you look at the news, you open up a magazine or the newspaper, the first thing you see is some prostate cancer, somebody dying from it, or how they're going to protect you from it, or every place you go. And it's the second largest killer of men in the United States. And it really strikes close to home sometimes. If you happen to look at the Juno Empire this past weekend on the Sunday paper, the Juno Douglas swim coach found out that he had it. And he didn't detect it early enough. If he would have been taking his screen test like he should have been, why, he may have stopped it. But he didn't do that, and he didn't detect it soon enough, and it spread to other parts of his body, and they gave him 17 to 35 months to live. And this is a major problem. I feel that we have to do something to encourage people, encourage men to take this simple test. And I believe that by making insurance companies provide this test and pay for it, that more men will be encouraged to take the test. And when you go in for your physical once a year or every other year, whatever you do, if that's included as part of your physical, it's paid for by your insurance company, you're going to take it. But if they say, well, I got to attach $30 or $40, whatever the cost is on there, you might say, well, I'll do it next time. And it's real easy to just say you wouldn't do it. But the whole thing is to catch this damn thing early enough so that it will they'll be able to treat it. If they catch it in the early stages, they can treat it and keep it from spreading. In most cases, it can cure it. But once it spreads, then you're in trouble and usually have a hell of a time curing it. And we would like to support this bill. And without the amendment, they have an amendment on here to offer instead of provide. We would like to keep it as it was, to provide, because if you offer it, why, they can say, well, we'll offer this test, and then you could end up paying for it. And if they provide it, why, you will get it free of cost. And I don't know anything else to say except that I would like to see this committee be able to say that they supported this bill and speedily passed it on to strike a blow against the second largest killer of men in the United States.
Thank you, Gene. Yes, Representative.
Oh, I just wanted to make a comment that I certainly agree that I want men to take more control and more be in charge of their health and be more aware of prostate cancer. It is, as you say, a hidden killer, and men are wimps compared to women in dealing with their health and talking about health issues.
But I have to disagree that the insurance companies will pay for this. Insurance companies aren't going to pay for it. You and I will pay for it by increased insurance premiums, and that just because it's a mandatory coverage doesn't mean the insurance company is taking out of their profit. They're simply going to raise premiums to cover that service.
Well, it looks to me like it would be an advantage to the insurance company to detect this thing at an early stage, and just like a preventative care that you have at your dentist. If you catch this thing at an early stage, it can save a lot of money down the road. It looks to me like insurance companies would be more than happy to catch the thing, and they would save money in the long run.
That's thank you. That's called preventative medicine, and that's always something that we advocate and don't always fund. Gene, you mentioned that this was your first PSA that you had received.
No, I've received three of them.
Okay, the three of the last 3 years?
Pardon?
The last 3 years?
I've had one just last year.
Okay, and I assume I was lucky that you have free. You're free of cancer.
Yes.
Will you ever go another year without getting one?
No, I'll have one at least every year or every 2 years.
And
for
will
sure.
you get one without the insurance company paying for it?
I probably would, being knowing what I know now.
Good for you. And
but
that's,
I
agree with you.
I think that, not speaking for myself alone, I think it would encourage more men to talk about it, more men to have it. I don't know if I was in some of the probably financial status that some older people are, on a fixed income, I probably wouldn't be able to afford it. Some people, $30 is a lot of money to them.
Right.
I think anything that we can do to encourage people to have this test, no matter, you know, if it's if we just get them to talk about it more and talk to their doctor, and the doctor can give this thing, I think anything that we can do would really, really help the situation, especially when it's the number two killer of men in the United States.
Right.
You're speaking about one of the big ones.
Mm-hmm. Gene, I think what you're talking about, I hear, is education. And AARP has a very vital role in this. And every month that they send their brochures or their newspaper out, they need to have either ads or articles in there urging people and discussing it over and over and over again. That's where the AARP needs to focus their attention. I personally don't think it's government's role to insist that you get a pap smear or a mammogram or a PSA test every year. I don't think that's our job. But anyway, that's my opinion. I think that's your job to get one.
Well, it's always been that way.
Yeah,
people know that it's a number two killer man in America. And I would say anything that we could do to encourage them, and we, by doing this, we'd certainly be encouraging them.
Right.
And that's my point. That's why I'm up here.
Thank you, Gene. I appreciate your testimony. Bill Chisholm?
You.
If you'd state your name for the record, please.
Bill Chisholm, resident of Juneau and a state employee. I'm speaking in favor of this legislation on my own, not as a state employee. In answer to a question that was asked a few minutes ago, the cost of this, in 1991, when Aetna paid for this examination for me, it was $77. I've had it every year. First 2 years, they paid for it. The last few years, they have not. I inquired 1 year, and they said, well, we apparently made a mistake before. And yes, each year I have incurred the cost myself. I've had the other examination also, but I'll tell you this, much as I hate blood tests, I'm just much more comfortable.
Amen.
I'm in that age range where I feel it's necessary to have this test, whether I pay for it or not, and I will continue to take it. I agree with the comment he made regarding the fact they don't pay for it, as they consider it as kind of a not a real medical procedure or an examination. The same as dental work, they will examine your teeth, and that's covered as preventative medicine, but they allude to the fact that this may be preventative medicine and therefore not covered. And I have some disagreement with that. So I'm in favor of having this legislation, and I'm not opposed to insurance companies. I did attend the Aetna School on Health Insurance a number of years ago, and I've spent about the last 30 years in reviewing insurance contracts and working on insurance matters. So that's my thoughts on this.
Thank you. Bill, may I suggest, and then Representative, may I suggest that you go to the health fair? The bill for the PSA is $30, and that's another thing we need to encourage, is that people attend those because it's half the price.
I agree.
Thank you. Representative Roper, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chair, Mr. Chisholm, as a claims person in the area of insurance, I'm curious. You said Aetna had drawn a distinction between this was a preventive type medicine vis-a-vis a treatment? Or
yes. That was my understanding, that they would be examining you with the potential of detecting something rather than treating something. I've always had a slight question as to how that would equate with going to the dentist on an annual basis and them finding a cavity and then taking the action to correct that, whereas they would not do this on the same basis. There's also apparently some medical opinion, certainly, which I'm not qualified to comment on, that perhaps this test is not the best way to find it. I think you can get testimony both sides on that. But when there are two tests available, and this offers a very scientific approach, I am slightly more in favor of this test than hoping that the examining physician and doing the other test has had a good day the day before and that he has his senses about him and can detect a minuscule difference in size or texture of what he's examining. And I think there's too much possibility that in the heat of the moment, the trying to examine, that they might overlook something like that. So I tend to have more faith in this test.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Bob Strohnacker.
Let me just ask a question.
Are you going to make a statement?
Sure.
Good.
Chair.
I've got some questions for you, too.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bob Stalnaker, Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. The administration supports this bill. We do see, as many of the comments have been made earlier, we all know there are certain things that we can do to find illnesses earlier on that will save the health costs, save the health costs into the future for both insurance companies, for employers, and so forth. How we get there from here is a hard step to take because it generally costs money to do that, to suffer the costs up front to be able to find illnesses in the earlier stage. This is a coverage, and to clarify a little bit about the state's plan, we don't deny this test all the time. We cover the test after the digital test has been performed, or if there's indications by the doctor that there is the need for this test for as a further test, then the plan will cover it. Also, the test itself is generally performed in a well physical, and that is a cost borne entirely by the employee at this point. That's why our fiscal note shows that there would be an impact on the plan. As Representative Bundy pointed out, there's no such thing as a free lunch. I mean, if you're going to increase a test, there's a cost to it. But the employees are paying this cost themselves now by virtue of the plan of the SBS Option 1.
Say that again. They are paying it now?
Well, the supplemental benefits Option 1 provision under the state plan provides for an annual well physical. Now, currently, the annual well physical will cover a digital exam, and only in the case that further test is needed will we then cover this test. So the current plan covers the digital exam. This bill would provide for the SBS to also cover the blood test as an initial test.
But if the doctor says to the patient, I would like to do the blood test also, then you will cover that.
Madam
if he finds something suspicious, then you will cover that.
Not if the doctor would like to. There has to be an indication. There has to be some kind of finding.
If he felt a thickening or whatever, and he said, I want you now to have a PSA test, then you would cover that. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, then that would be covered, yes.
Okay, further questions?
Yeah.
Yes, Representative Veazey, and then Bryce.
I was going to say, I don't know. My doctor must not have very good bedside manner because I don't have a lot of choice in these things when I go see him. But,
no options.
If the administration feels that this is a good idea, and I'm not sure why they think it's a good idea, but why don't they just negotiate it into their contract? We don't need a law to negotiate benefits for employee health coverage.
Through the chair, Representative Veazey, that's true for the state. And yes, the state employees can, through negotiation, amend the health contracts or their provisions and include these provisions at whatever that cost is, which would not be much. The administration support is as a public policy. Is that in early detection you can help find the number two killer of men in the country at an early stage where not only can treatment be provided that will save lives, but also at a much lower cost to the health industry as a whole. So the administration support is based on the policy issue that pre-advance notice through this kind of test is more accurate than just a digital type of an exam.
Then why doesn't the administration negotiate that into the health benefits package for the state employees? Why are we passing a statute to do what the administration, who is in a position to put it in the contract, thinks is a good idea?
Through the chair, Representative Veazey, I'm not part of the negotiations, first of all, for labor contracts. I'm not sure what the strategy is right now with negotiating on the contracts for this unique provision. So I really can't speak to if the administration is or why it isn't negotiating to include this under the plan. As I said before, the inclusion of this under the state health plan deals with state employees, and it does not deal with the coverage of this kind of a treatment in general. And that's what we're here testifying for today.
On that, go ahead.
I just say an awful lot of state employees are not a part of a bargaining unit. They're covered by a state plan that the administration puts together on their behalf.
Yes.
If the administration thinks that this is a good policy, why don't they negotiate that into that service?
Through the chair, Representative Veazey, as you may be aware, we are looking at a change in the health plan for non-covered employees. That would include a flexible benefit plan that employees then could select certain types of coverages. There would be minimal coverages. As a matter of fact, under that plan, one of the minimal coverages is a well physical for everybody every year. Because, once again, it's been determined that that is a good idea, that people get physicals from time to time. Not an anticipation everybody would do it, but certainly that it's there. So the idea of preventative care or the idea of early detection would be embedded in that idea or in that approach to the to the flexible plan that we're looking at.
Representative Veazey.
Then, is your testimony that the administration intends to make this sort of health care as a mandatory provision of that's employees' health care packages for non-covered employees, at least, if not for covered employees.
Through the chair, the administration's position is that these types of treatments are good for the health costs as a whole for early detection. What part of these coverages, whether it be pap smears, whether it be, well, mammograms are already mandated coverage, but that these kind of early detection tests are beneficial. What the end result, because the end result of the health plan will be the result of a group of people that will include legislative employees as well as executive branch employees as well as court system employees, deciding exactly what kind of coverages will be provided. So I can't speak to a guarantee, but certainly the administration is supportive of early detection and the types of tests that would help to provide early detection.
Well, does that mean that the administration is going to insist that this sort of medical plan be included in its health care programs in the future or not?
Through the chair, Representative Veazey, I can't speak specifically for what the plan will look like at the end of the day. What I can say is that the group that has worked on this plan to this date, meaning the supervisor bargaining unit as well as the administration, believes that there is value to early detection tests and types of medical treatments that would provide early detection.
Excuse me, let me break in here. Why aren't they here today? Why did I not have the good judgment to ask them to come to this meeting?
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir. Who? The people you just said are making the decisions on what is included in these new contracts. How are we going to get the word to them that we feel, we as a body or we and everybody in this room feels that this is necessary? We've all stated we know it's necessary. We know that it's good judgment to get these tests out there. And excuse me for interrupting you. But maybe this is what we need, is better communication between all of us so that you can tell me, have these people here. I should have known that, and that would probably have saved us a lot of time. So we might just hold this bill until Tuesday. What is today? Today's Tuesday. Until Thursday, next Tuesday, and have these people here so that we can tell them what we want. Maybe I'll get a list from people. Representative Veazey, I'm sorry, I broke in, and you probably weren't finished.
I almost was. I'm sorry. You testified that the administration supported this bill, and then you testified that they thought this would be a good idea to put in the contract, but they weren't sure. And it really comes back to, I mean, is administration sure they think this bill is a good deal, a good bill? I mean, it seems like we went in a big circle.
Through the chair, Representative Veazey, the administration thinks this bill is a good idea.
Thank you.
Just to clarify that, do they think the testing is a good idea? Or do they think the bill is a good idea? They're two different, vastly different things.
Madam Chair, they think the testing is a good idea.
Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you. Representative Robinson. I'm sorry. Yeah. Then you're next.
No, I was next.
No.
I'm mad. I'm going to.
Two questions I have. And the first question is that this bill, as written, basically provides this coverage to all people of the state, not just state employees.
To the chair, Representative Robinson, that's correct.
Okay. Another number two, it would appear being that the legislature has continued to say that they want any contract negotiations to come in at a lower amount. Obviously, this would be, at this point, a difficult thing to negotiate in.
Through the chair, Representative Robinson, that's true also. As well, I might add, is there's been some comments at times that the state's plan is very generous. And certainly that is a sensitive issue as the unions negotiate and the administrations negotiate.
Chair, one more time. So, so obviously what the administration is saying right now, they believe as preventative measure that is important that all insurance coverage for health benefits offer the opportunity for people to be able to get this kind of screening and have it paid for.
through the chair, Representative Robinson. That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Bundy, I apologize.
It's a perfect timing because Representative Robinson had two very important keywords, opportunity and offering. And as a person who's could be impacted by prostate cancer, I've done some reading and I have some concerns about it. And I would, I may be asking you out of your field, but I, being we are considering some mandatory insurance here, I have read that, and while I choose to take part in it, that on a statistical average nationwide, by taking part in this test, it extends the life expectancy of prostate cancer sufferers by 6 months. That it may, in some cases, decrease the quality of life because people get a PSA test that's high, and they jump into surgery, and then they're a young person in their 40s or something, and they're incontinent the rest of their life. And, you know, this isn't the best thing since sliced bread, I guess is what I'm saying. It has some downsides. It should be probably a personal decision weighed in with other factors. It is not going to prevent or cure prostate cancer by any means. Is that
through the chair, Co-Chair Bundy, that's certainly correct, as is the alternative, not the best thing since sliced bread. That was pointed out earlier, and it's not pleasant at all. However, there's no such thing as a sure bet. As the technology improves, and certainly I think I would agree, certainly the things I've read, there's been weaknesses as well as strengths with this kind of test. There's needs to be communication with the test to explain to people just what these numbers mean, as best as they know. However, it is a way that through a general battery of blood tests, I mean, they can take the blood, they can run a battery of normal blood tests, of other things that are covered. And we've had cases where they've run the battery and done the PSA as part of a battery, and then it's been denied because of no medical necessity. Mm-hmm. And that's part of a $30 cost, is if they're running it as part of a battery, it helps cut the cost from that $70 to $80 range. And we anticipate there'll be some type of an interaction like this. If it is a normal part of a battery of blood tests, then it will lower the cost in the future for these kind of tests, as well as enhance education. And as was pointed out earlier, that's an important part of all this.
Excuse me, can we have a break for our tape lady?
We can.
Gladys, you'll be. Thank you.